Welcome to the latest global news recorded at 4 o'clock GMT on Friday the 30th of April. I'm Julian Keane with a selection of highlights from across BBC World Service news today. Coming up, an oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico reaches land, prompting fears of an environmental disaster. Belgium's parliament votes to ban the burqa, a new treatment in the fight against cancer. The Australian balloon launch, which went disastrously wrong, and a designer's take on China's World Expo. But first, the oil spill off the United States. The U.S. military has been called in to help out with the response and the cleanup after the massive oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico. 5,000 barrels of oil are seeping from the feeder pipe, which was ruptured when the Deepwater Horizon platform exploded and sank last week. The oil slick is rapidly developing into one of the worst the world has ever seen, with the potential to cause enormous damage to the marine environment and coastal regions of the southern United States. President Obama has said this is now a crisis of national proportions, allowing him to release federal resources to help.
While BP is ultimately responsible for funding the cost of response and cleanup operations, my administration will continue to use every single available resource at our disposal, including potentially the Department of Defense, to address the incident.
Billy Nungesser is president of Plaquemine Parish near the mouth of the Mississippi. I spoke to him shortly after he just returned from surveying the slick from a helicopter over the ocean.
We're very worried. I flew offshore with Congressman Lawson. We just got back right at dock. And the boom that they have deployed offshore, for what we could see, is not really working. It's being overtopped. Some of it has sunken. Some of it has broken loose. And we don't see it really being effective. So tomorrow morning, we will ask the Coast Guard and BP to give us some information, kind of our worst-case scenario. Where will this oil end up? Inland in Plaquemines Parish. And we will try to come up with a line of defense somewhere in the marsh where the wave action is less. And we'll kind of try to take a last stand there. It will be on shore by morning. We will then try to keep it out of the breeding grounds of the oyster and fishery and salvage 90% of Plaquemines Parish.
As things stand and as we speak, I mean, how close is the oil to that marshland?
Well, some of it is touching the Barrier Islands now. We saw a portion of the boom that had been pushed up by the waves onto the beach and saw some oil there on the beach. So it has made landfall. We've got reports tonight of it being in a couple of the bayous just off of the Gulf. And so it's making its way inland, and it will continue to do that through the night.
In your role as parish president, I guess you've never seen anything like this.
No, I tell you, I've been through Gustav and Ike and the Katrina recovery. And, you know, we've always prepared for the worst and hope for the best. But what I feel like right now for the last 3 days, we've been relying on other people to fight this offshore, and because we don't have a good indication of how to fight this thing. It's something we've never seen before. But we're not used to sitting on our hands and waiting. We're used to getting up and doing the work ourselves, and this is something new for us. This is a monster we have not had to fight yet, and it's not something like Exxon, where we know how much oil has been spilled. It's an open faucet at the bottom of that ocean that continues to pump oil into the ocean. And we don't know the long-term effects and how long and for how long that oil will come ashore.
Can we say the community is resilient, determined to fight back?
Absolutely. Listen, this parish, I like to say there's something special about the soil under people's feet that they don't leave. I don't know what it is, but they keep coming back. This is home. They're not going anywhere. And whatever it takes, we're going to fight and do all we can to save this community.
The Deepwater Horizon oil platform, which blew up and sank, causing this massive oil spill, was operated by BP. Neil Chapman is a BP spokesman. We got through to him at the Deepwater Horizon Unified Control Center in Louisiana.
Look, this is very, very serious. At no time do you ever want oil on the water, and you don't want it wherever it's in this sense, where you haven't been able to control the source as you wanted to. The last few days, we've been really ramping up the response offshore. We've been putting out thousands of gallons of dispersants. A third of the world's dispersants are in this region and ready to deploy. We've been putting out boom. We've been putting out skimmers. We've got 70 vessels out on the Gulf of Mexico. At the same time, we've been attacking it at its source in order to try and shut in that blowout preventer using remotely operated vehicles, and also been getting ready to drill a relief well, and at the same time building a containment system that would capture the escaping oil under the surface of the oil before it reaches the sea surface.
Controlling the source is absolutely key, because you don't know the scale of the problem until you've shut it off. How close are you? Can you give anybody any kind of reassurance that you are close to shutting it off?
I don't want to do that, but what I do know, well, in terms of the time scale, we're attacking at different methods in parallel, and we don't know which one will work first.
This is hugely damaging for BP. It's not the first incident related to safety and to leaks inside the US, and under US law, BP is liable for the cleanup.
BP is the responsible party, and we are, as part of that, doing everything we can. Our goal is to deal with the spill. What you've said about some of the problems we've had, you're absolutely right, we have. But the one thing that hits me personally and everybody involved in this effort is the fact that the origin of this was the fact that 11 people died, and they were Transocean employees and some contractors. And to me, that's awful. And that's what's driving everybody I know and the 1,000 people involved in this response, the memory of those people who died.
Neil Chapman of BP. Belgium has a Muslim population of about 500,000. Among that number, there are some who wear the full face veil. Not many, but enough to attract attention from some Belgian politicians. The Belgian Parliament has voted overwhelmingly to ban the wearing of face veils like the burqa in public. One of the arguments in favour was the security need to identify people clearly. Another was that the full face veil is oppressive to women. Georges Dallemagne is the MP who sponsored the bill.
We decided that there was a very big breach in this new way of wearing clothes, which have never been worn in Europe. There has never been a veil in all the history of Europe covering the entire face of women. And we have seen that in the population, that has been a big shock for them. There are not very many women wearing this veil, but they are 20 times more than 3 years or 4 years ago. So it depends how you see the issue, but that's something which is not very common, but that's much more common than a few years ago. So that's a new element, and we have decided not to wait until they are again 20 times the number we see in the streets in Belgium today.
Well, in reply, the executive of Belgian Muslims said the ban was as intolerant an attitude as those of the Taliban. Malika Hamidi is director of the European Muslim Network based in Brussels. What does she make of this latest development?
What has been decided is totally ridiculous. I think that it's a signal which is launched to the Muslim community saying that Islam is a problem and Islam is not welcome. We all know that this debate is targeting the Muslim communities. We all know that this problem is of marginal importance. There is no statistic in Belgium today concerning the number of women who are wearing the niqab. So it's just a problem of marginal importance. Why voting a law which is going to be counterproductive?
Can I ask you, Malika, what kind of headscarf or veil you wear yourself when you're out and about in Brussels?
I wear the headscarf.
So a hijab, a full face cover?
No, I don't wear a niqab because I apply what the majority of the Muslim scholars are saying. And I think that it's not a religious prescription, even if we know that a minority of scholars are saying that it's a prescription. But I think that it's not a religious prescription.
But do you think that women who do wear full face cover have the right to do so under Islam and under society?
Yes, of course, I do respect that choice because they really think that they are applying an Islamic principle. And personally, I do respect those women, but I would not like that those women force me or impose me a niqab. But I think that it's their choice and that we have to respect it. I think wearing the niqab doesn't harm anybody in the street.
Do you think that the Belgian lawmakers are interested in hearing that argument that you've just made?
You know, the Belgian government and the Belgian politicians have not consulted the Muslim community at all. I mean, we criticized the position of France, but at least France had a national consultation. They had discussion and exchanges with Muslim leaders, Muslim intellectuals. But in Belgium, it's such a surprise because we were not consulted. They didn't ask us what we are thinking about this law, which is threatening our individual liberty. I just think that this kind of law today is just politically profitable. It's such a pity that we have not been consulted, because I think that they can't imagine what will be the consequences of such a law.
What consequences do you fear?
I heard women wearing the niqab who were saying that she will stay at home, she won't go out. So, you know, they say that in the name of the dignity of women, in the name of emancipation, we have to liberate those women from this niqab. But, you know, the result will be the opposite. It's counterproductive. Personally, I'm against the burqa, but the way to deal with that problem is not by legislating with a law. You are not going to find a solution and to resolve this kind of problem by legislating in such an issue.
Malika Hamidi of the European Muslim Network. Now, there is what sounds like a major development in the fight against cancer. A new drug, Provenge, developed to treat prostate cancer, has just been approved by the US government's Food and Drug Administration. Provenge offers an important alternative to current treatments such as chemotherapy. What's new is that it treats the cancer by stimulating the body's own immune system, as I heard from Dr. Otis Brawley, Chief Medical Officer of the American Cancer Society.
Instead of giving a vaccine like I would for influenza, where I give the shot in someone's muscle and then treat their white cells while they're actually in the person's body, with this treatment, you have to apheresis the patient, take the white cells out of the patient, send them to a laboratory, actually mail them to a laboratory by overnight mail. At the laboratory, they treat those white cells, mail them back to the physician, who gives them back to the patient by intravenous injection. And that is a treatment for prostate cancer.
It is clearly different from existing treatments. How much of a sort of breakthrough is it?
Well, I actually think that this is more of a breakthrough for cancer in general, because this will ultimately be used in other diseases, melanoma, breast cancer, not just prostate cancer. But this is a unique treatment. It's something we've never had before. And amazingly, in the clinical trials, this treatment prolongs survival of men with a very difficult prostate cancer to treat, what we call hormone unresponsive prostate cancer. These are men who've been treated with hormonal therapies. Many of them have been treated with chemotherapies. These are men who are going to die if they don't get treated for their prostate cancer.
For the layman, it seems really to make sense. It's your body which is the best machine to fight back against this disease.
Yeah, you know, for over 40 years, we have actually tried to figure out ways to stimulate one's body to treat cancer. We've had mild success, very mild success, in kidney cancer and in melanoma by giving shots to stimulate the immune system. But this is the first real treatment like this where we're transfusing white cells. And this is actually a big step. It may seem like a baby step when I say median survival increasing by 4.5 months. But for those of us who treat cancer, this is a huge, huge, I really should say for cancer doctors, this is probably more exciting than for cancer patients right now. And I'm hoping that 10 years from now, this is going to be really successful in prolonging people's lives even more than that 4.5 months median.
Dr. Otis Brawley. A research balloon the size of a football field has crashed on takeoff in central Australia, wrecking its payload of scientific equipment worth millions of dollars. The balloon was designed to carry sensitive instruments 40 kilometers into the atmosphere to observe gamma and X-rays as part of an international project, and Kemi Fijika reports.
The scientists were there to send their equipment soaring into the sky in the name of knowledge, and the onlookers were there to witness the spectacle of a balloon the size of a football field fade into the distance. What they got instead was a mini disaster movie. As the balloon was filling up with air at the launch site in Alice Springs, the payload attached to it came loose from its mooring. It was then dragged across the site, overturning a car and just missing another. Debris fell from the payload as it careened for a few more meters before coming to a standstill. Video footage of people standing close to the launch site shows them running for their lives. Betty Davis had a lucky escape.
We were sitting in our car and preparing to move it out of the way, and we actually were within about a foot of being wiped out, I think.
Betty's husband, Stan, was with her in the car.
There was a great slam and there was large pieces of white debris flying through the air everywhere, and basically that was it. It was just an instance of chaos outside.
The balloon was a collaboration between Berkeley University in California and several Taiwanese universities. A professor in charge of the operation said that quick changing wind conditions can cause launch difficulties. The group says it will try again next month.
And Kami Fujika reporting there. You're listening to Global News from the BBC World Service. The three leaders of Britain's biggest political parties have made their final televised pitch for power ahead of next week's general election, at least while all sharing the same stage. Last night they held the last of their televised debates in the city of Birmingham in the English Midlands. For their third confrontation in as many weeks, they concentrated on the economy. And yet independent analysts who've looked in detail at the three economic manifestos say all three main parties have not fully costed their plans or clearly identified the areas where public spending cuts will be made, a point which may well have informed the first question from the audience.
We all know there's going to be spending cuts after the general election, no matter who wins. Why can't you be honest and tell us?
The leaders then spent 20 minutes not answering the question, but they did engage in debating each other's policies. Labour's Gordon Brown and the Conservative challenger David Cameron clashed on jobs.
We do not want a generation of young people growing up and not working. That's what happened in the 1980s under David's party. They left a generation, a wasted generation, and we've been dealing with the consequences. We've got to get young people into work. We cannot have a situation where they're on the street corners, and we can't have a Conservative Party that keeps opposing all our jobs proposals, including our future jobs fund, that is designed to stop youth unemployment in the country. I just think the Conservative Party are still living in the age of the 1980s and 1990s.
Mr. Cameron,
and it's the same old Tories.
I'm a little bit unsure about which country Gordon Brown thinks he's Prime Minister of, because in Britain today, there are actually 900,000 young people not in employment, not in education, not in training. He's caused record youth unemployment. We see unemployment today 40% higher than when he came to power in 1997, after the longest and deepest recession in our history. So to talk about this as if somehow he's got a magnificent economic record is nonsense.
Mr. Cameron and Liberal Democrat leader Nick Clegg argued about immigration.
Nick has talked, not tonight, but has talked about 600,000 people having this amnesty, being able to stay, and they would be able to bring over a relative each. So that's 1.2 million potentially. And all those people would have access to welfare and to housing. I think this could make
us... Why don't we save time?
This could make the... Will you explain the number then?
Why don't we save time? Instead of making endlessly misleading comments, you know, let's just save time and assume every time you talk about our policy, it's just wrong. What I'm saying is there is a layer of illegal immigrants...
Well, give us the number.
We have to deal with it. We have to get them out of the hands of criminals. And you say numbers. Can you now tell me... Am I right or wrong that 80% of people who come here come from the European Union, and your cap would make no difference to that whatsoever? Is that right, yes or no?
We have said
yes or no.
New EU countries should have transitional controls.
And Mr. Clegg and Mr. Brown disagreed about green energy.
We should be a world leader in manufacturing this new green technology. And yet the only manufacturer of onshore wind turbines has recently closed, and the London Array project, which is one of the biggest offshore wind projects off the coast of Kent, 90% of the stuff that's being installed there was built in Denmark and Germany. Why are we not using small amounts of money to invest in old dockyards and shipyards so that we manufacture the new green technologies of the future as well?
But Nick, wind turbines and the development of the offshore wind industry is one of our priorities. And we are now the world's leading offshore wind power. And there are four companies, including Siemens, that have announced that they're going to invest in wind power in this country as a result of government incentives. And we're doing the same for digital because we want 100% super fast.
So, some examples there of the exchanges in the debate. But what can we learn about the effect these debates will have on the UK voting public? A seasoned observer of political debates is Mark Penn, who's advised Bill Clinton, Hillary Clinton, and Tony Blair.
These are incredibly serious affairs. These debates were packed policy to policy in a way that American debates just aren't. Sure. There was very little humorous or other interaction among the candidates. Now, obviously, it would be harder to say that Nick Clegg could possibly have done better through these debates. I think Brown needed to revive and invigorate his campaign. He didn't do that. Cameron needed to close the sale. He came close. He finally hit on the strategy, I think, in this debate of trying to identify some of the really difficult, troublesome policies in the liberal Democratic agenda. And what did Nick Clegg do? He did what any experienced television debater does. He just denies them and lets people figure it out afterward.
Part of the problem with the debating process was that there is relatively little to divide the main parties on some of the crucial questions. One or two little bits of policy difference. But apart from that, the general direction of all of them is pretty similar.
Well, I think that they all see that somehow they're going to need to be cuts of some kind. Remember, originally Labour said there would be no cuts. Then they changed when they decided that that was just an untenable position. And so the question became, what kind of cuts? I think that change was a mistake for Labour, because if you're going to vote for cuts, you're going to vote for somebody you think is better at cutting. And typically the Tories are going to be the party that does that. So I think that gave more of an edge to Cameron on the issue of what are we going to do about the budget. And that also, I think, gave up the great strength of the Labour Party.
You watched the final debate with business leaders here in London. What do they make of this?
I think the business leaders saw this as a very serious debate about the issues that they really care about the most. What's going to happen to interest rates, the budget cuts, the deficit spending, and ultimately economic growth. In the end, we took a poll among the 130 or so business leaders. Those business leaders thought Cameron won by about 2-1. They thought Brown came in second. They thought Clegg came in third. This is different from the public polls, where Cameron still won by much less than our poll of business leaders, and Clegg came in decisively second, with Brown trailing.
Mark Penn there on that British TV debate. For the past 22 years, the United States has barred anyone who is not American and who has HIV or AIDS from coming into or even traveling through U.S. territory. That law has been allowed to lapse and the HIV travel ban has been lifted. But still, some people were caught up in a bureaucratic catch-22 situation. Heide Marie Kramer is a German doctor who lives in America but has been fighting deportation because she's HIV positive. She's now won her case. What does this legal victory mean to her?
This is a beautiful day for me. I feel like I'm getting my freedom back, the freedom to travel, the freedom to rejoin with my family, the freedom to continue my international work, which is very vital to me. It's a great day for me.
It's been a long struggle, I think 10 years or more.
Almost 9 years. It's been 4 years that I haven't been able to see my mom. The last time I was able to go to Germany was when my dad passed away, which means I have twins growing up without a family. I mean, for my family it's very difficult to come, particularly my mother, who's dying and on oxygen and longing to see us. She can't make it over the ocean, and we feel like cut off. The U.S. for those 4 years felt like a big prison for me.
Mm. This must feel to you like, you know, the doors are open to a full working life from now on.
Not yet.
Not
removing
yet.
Removing the HIV bar is not over. This is just one piece, and China also is going to open its door. Yet there is a lot to do before HIV travel and immigration bans drop globally. For example, my kids are still separated from their dad, who has been voluntarily deported, although being HIV negative, based on the HIV positive status of myself, his wife. And he was not able to re-enter the U.S. and has a 10-year bar to come to the U.S. to see his kids.
So he wasn't just thrown out. They actually banned him from coming back for 10 years.
Yes.
What is the prospect of getting that overturned?
I don't know. The prospect is me today. In a couple of weeks, I will be able to travel again, and I have to go out of the country so that kids can rejoin with their father again. Also, I still have a stamp in my passport. Whenever I cross a border, it shows that I'm in the category of criminals for being HIV positive, because I had an HIV waiver, which is kind of a stamp in the passport. And whenever I want to go to another country, it looks as I have convicted a crime.
You clearly don't see that the stigma of AIDS through, in your case, an ugly stamp in your passport, the stigma is not gone.
The stigma is not gone, and it's the stigma of HIV that leads to the spread of HIV. And my vision is that since AIDS has now taken half as many lives as World War II, and if we continue to live like that, it's going to take more than World War II, we need to get HIV testing and treatment at a cost of less than $1 a day. And I know this is possible to do it if we change the patent rights and just globally change our attitude and approach to HIV/AIDS, and that would provide global access at a low cost, wouldn't be a burden on the economy, and would solve the HIV epidemic.
Heide Marie Kramer. You remember the Beijing Olympics from a couple of years ago? Well, China is about to host another international festival, the Shanghai Expo 2010, and it's cost $45 billion. Expos are trade fairs masquerading as cultural exchanges, or, as Shanghai claims, a gala of civilizations, all about new life concepts and the exchange of wisdom. Countries bring national pavilions to the expo to show off anything, really. The French pavilion is called the Sensual City. Spain's has a skirt like a flamenco dancer. The Saudis have date palms. And the British one looks like a brush. Stephen Bailey is a design historian. So where do expos come from? After all, who'd invent one from scratch?
I think the international exhibition or exposition is a defining institution of the modern world. I mean, like the department store and like the museum, to which they're obviously related. You know, the whole world is put on display for analysis and contemplation and very possibly for sale. I think the first modern exhibition was the 1851 Great Exhibition of the Industry of All Nations, which happened in London. It had a fabulous purpose-built building, the largest glass and iron structure of its type ever, which became known as the Crystal Palace. The other important exhibitions have often left behind, and they're remarkable landmarks. I mean, Paris's Eiffel Tower was a temporary exhibition building for the Paris Exposition of 1889. The electric light bulb and Elisha Graves' Otis's electric lift were first demonstrated in exhibitions in America. In 1925 in Paris, there was the magnificent Exposition des Arts Décoratifs, which gave rise to that movement in architecture and design we know as Art Deco. So exhibitions, these things, they can have extraordinary effects. Whether it remains in our sort of pixelated and data-driven virtual age, whether the physical exhibition remains especially valuable or viable activity, I'm not so certain, although the Chinese clearly believe it has some relevance.
Now, you're talking about something 150 years ago, which is sort of the height of British imperialism, to do with commerce, diplomacy, branding the nation. Is there that much change 150 years on? What do you see behind an expo like the Shanghai Expo?
I think I see a lot in common between what's happening in Shanghai now and what was happening in London in 1851. Two vast empires are requiring the world to pay tribute. This is an act of vast pride. The Shanghai Exhibition, it's all about China's emergence, isn't it? It's about China promoting itself. We are being elevated, to the top table of nations. We are responsible and outgoing. We wish to participate and collaborate in the international world of industry and design. The big question is, now that Chinese have control the majority of manufacturing resources and own most of the world's money, the question is, are we going to see a revolution in Chinese taste? I mean, is there going to be an authentic Chinese style emerging in a modern Chinese style emerging in architecture and design? I don't know. The evidence so far is no.
Design historian Stephen Bailey. That's all from us for now, but an updated version of the Global News podcast will be available for you to download later today. I'm Julian Keane. Thanks for listening.